This is PWTorch.com editor Wade Keller with an introduction to today's part two of the Lanny Poffo Torch Talk. This ran in text format in Pro Wrestling Torch Newsletter issue number 1043, cover dated September 13th, 2008. The interview was conducted on August 24th, 2008, and this is the second installment, and we now go to the first question.
And by the same token, what do you think Randy might have ended up doing, if not for wrestling?
Well, he's in a situation where he absolutely doesn't have to do anything ever again, because in the words of Robert Kiyosaki, rich dad, poor dad, it's about passive income.
Yeah.
And when your passive income, you know, is greater than your cost of living, you've got financial security.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I'm there too. It's just that I need balance in my life. I have to work a little because I've got energy and, you know, I tried retirement and I wound up watching a lot of TV and gaining weight.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I had a list of things I was going to do in my life. I did about three of them and then wound up watching a lot of TV.
Yeah.
You know, I just saw the movie The Bucket List. I love that movie. But eventually you got to come home and, you know, anyway, I love selling cars, but I don't want to do it full time.
Yeah. Would you, if Randy and you had never ever gotten into wrestling, it sounds like you might have gone into sales. You might have gone into sales. If Randy just never got into wrestling, I guess that's what I'm getting at. What do you think his life path would have taken him?
Well, you got to remember that Randy was on the National Honor Society. He was a scholastic student with a almost a 4.0 average.
Yeah.
You know, top of the class.
Yeah.
When he was playing baseball, he was playing cards to supplement his income with all these bonus babies, and he does not cheat. He believes in karma, you know?
Yeah.
And he's just good at cards, and he just played and took everybody's pants off. All these bonus babies, you know, a fool and his money are soon parted.
Yeah.
So, you know, he could have been a riverboat gambler, a dealer in Las Vegas. If he was in sales, he could have been fantastic because, you know, he's got a great personality. He doesn't have trouble with the learning curve. I was called the genius. My grades weren't as good as his. But I was one of those, you know, I had attention deficit disorder and I was great at English, foreign languages, history. I could go on Jeopardy and know everything about history. And every poem that I've ever recited are poems that I have written. So wrestling not being on the level, my gimmick was on the level. Sometimes they told me who I was going to wrestle right before I went on, and I'd write a poem real fast and do it on national television.
Jeez.
And I resented Chief J. Strongbow for putting me through that, you know,
yeah.
Because I think he did it on purpose.
Right.
No, I know he did it on purpose, and there was nothing I could do about it, but he is a complete ass for doing it, and I asked him not to, but he kept doing it, so there was nothing I could do, but you know what? You know what I finally told him? I said, well, good thing I'm really the genius then. Well, actually, I was Leaping Lanny at the time.
Yeah.
I said, good thing I'm really good at this because, you know, you can't stop me
mm-hmm.
as much as you're trying to, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, he was, he's just a miserable old man and, you know, with very few friends.
Yeah, that's too bad. Well, let me, one or two more childhood stories before I move to the wrestling career. What kind of trouble, if any, did you and Randy get in as kids, either on your own or maybe at wrestling shows, if your dad brought you or anything like that? Just kind of maybe a story that would, you know, convey a little bit more about
actually, neither of us got in trouble ever. you know, Randy was more prone to fighting than I was. And, but he never got, arrested or kept after school.
Yeah.
Yeah. To my knowledge, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were no different than anybody else, but, it's about getting away with it that counts, you know.
Yes. Yep.
And when I went to CarMax, you know, they just about did a proctor on me, you know, to see if I had any past history, you know, of, because they won't hire you if you have a felony or misdemeanor. And we just lost about 4 people over the last 2 years because of driving while drunk, getting your license removed. And, you know, you can't work for CarMax like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can't I'd love to tell you a colorful story, but I have nothing for you.
Sure, fair enough. Yeah. How about when, did your dad bring you to matches when you were a kid? I mean, do you have
yeah.
memories of being
yeah. We went to matches, we went to the dressing rooms. You know, my favorite wrestler was Johnny Valentine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I always, boy, there's a guy that made it look real.
Yeah.
And then I found out that, you know, while Billy Red Lions told me that in Toronto, he made it look so real that a lot of the wrestlers got a petition together. They didn't want to work with him because he was hurting them.
Oh, wow.
You know, he was, by then he was laying him in so hard that it became his gimmick.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of the wrestlers didn't want to put up with it. So they petitioned against him. And yet, you know, the man had something special to offer the business. He only had about 5 moves, but every one of them looked, and that facial expression, you know, he was definitely a strange person. You wouldn't believe it, but I tried to copy him a few times, and I realized how ridiculous it was because I didn't have the look, the build, or anything Johnny Valentine-ish. The only thing I was a good fan of his.
Yeah.
So I had to develop style as a heel and babyface.
Yep.
Well, I just remember Dick the Bruiser against Johnny Valentine.
Yeah.
And there weren't very many people in the International Amphitheater because, Billy, Fred Kohler was the promoter, mm-hmm. and he was selling it to Bruiser and Schneider and Gagne. And, they had lost their big TV. And, they were getting in, UHF station channel 26, which was like the little circular wire on your TV, and a lot of people didn't have that. So they were just trying to build Chicago back. And I remember they're working very, very hard, even though there was a lot of empty seats. But slowly but surely, they, next thing you know, a couple years later, they're drawing big houses in the amphitheater. So much so that they had to go to Soldier's Field for a couple of summer spectaculars.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember how hard they worked, you know, that even though there wasn't a big crowd, everybody, you know, did their very best. I was also a big fan of Wilbur Snyder, Pat O'Connor. You know, I could tell the good ones from the bad ones.
Yeah, yep. Were there any that were actually role models for you when you were going to the show, you know, as a kid, who just, obviously in addition to your father, who you looked up to?
Well, role model, Killer Kowalski, who is now hanging by a thread.
Yeah.
He was all the time talking about photography, vegetarianism, health food. And you know, I know that he's a little past 80 years old and, but you gotta remember tall people don't live as long just like fat people don't. You know.
I didn't know that. That worries me.
Are you tall or fat?
6'3". I'm tall,
well,
not that.
I'm about 6'1½", almost 6'2".
Yeah.
But Kowalski was a giant.
Yeah.
Not compared to Andre, but you know, he's a big man. And, so talk about a role model. I was influenced by his lectures a lot.
Yeah.
And he got me reading a lot of Paul Bragg and Edgar Cayce and, Kowalski was an interesting guy. You know, I just thinking a lot about him lately because, you know, I'm in touch
yeah.
with his wife and seeing, you know, what's up with him. I'm sure he's not long for the world. They took him off life support.
Yeah, yeah.
Heard. And also, Paul Christie was a very dear friend of mine. And I was lucky enough to know him and as I was getting into wrestling. And, you know, I was a little shy with girls and he helped me with that too, you know, because I had a bad complexion and I was a little shy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Chrissy had absolutely no trouble with girls at all.
Yeah.
And he broke, you know, he said, I give you the boy, bring me back the man. And,
oh,
For that, I certainly do owe him a couple of million dollars.
And expand on that story a little bit. How did that all work out?
I was 16 years old and a virgin, and he asked me if I wasn't. I said, yeah. What's the most I'd have done? Oh, I felt the girl up at a party, you know. So he got me a girl, and in Paducah, Kentucky, in the Continental Inn, he arranged the whole thing, and I was deflowered that night, and I got myself a very interesting hobby.
Which was?
Womanizing.
Gotcha. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's move officially into talking about training to become a professional wrestler. Did you, obviously with a father as a wrestler, you didn't have to go pay for training school. You didn't have to decide, do I travel across the country and, you know, which trainer has a better reputation, that type of thing. You kind of had a in-house training setup, but how did you formally go about actually kind of going from non-wrestler to wrestler?
Okay, first of all, Paducah, Kentucky, and then I went to, Christmas of 1973,
mm-hmm.
About 6 months after I graduated, I went to work for Tom Renesso and Ann Gunkel, because my dad failed to get me booked for Jim Barnett. See, my father got me booked. And then, getting a guy booked is not easy if you don't know the number, you know. So.
Yeah, that's true. Especially so before
Tom Renesso assured my father, he says, I'm going to treat him like a son. Mm-hmm. I'm going to treat him like my own son. So, about 3 weeks later, my dad left me there in Atlanta, and I was wrestling for Gunkel's Enterprises. And Tom Renesso brings me into his office, and he says, Lanny, I see that you've been in contact with Nicky Steinborn. And he says, I promised your father that I would treat you like my own. Hmm. And he says, Nicky Steinborn is a very, very interesting person. He's a fun person to be around. And if you hang around him, you're going to be a moral degenerate like he is. He is an educated idiot. He's charming. And within 6 months of being in his company, you're going to be down that road. Hmm. He says, do you call your father? I said, yes. He says, I want you to call him tonight. Tell him every word I said and have him verify it. And then come see me, you know, to make sure that I'm not giving you the wrong information. And so I didn't, you know, but, you know, wrestling is such a loosely moral group of people. It's amazing when one person stands out as the degenerate among degenerates.
Yes.
It's like when you go to prison, the pedophile gets beat up.
Yep.
You know, this guy is a murderer and this guy is a income tax guy, and you know, but they have their standards, you know.
Go ahead and talk about the early time in your actual being a wrestler and also just trying to learn the ropes, literally, you know, how when you first were starting to get paid and this was your profession. Talk about that learning curve and how you went about actually kind of going from wrestling with your brother and having fun in that in an informal way and really becoming a full-fledged pro.
Well, there's a book called that my father swears by. This it's called The Richest Man in Babylon by Klassen,
mm-hmm.
And it's about 100 years old. And rule number one: a part of all you earn is yours to keep. So, and then you're supposed to say, "Well, all I earn is mine to keep, isn't it?"
Yeah.
No, you have to pay for your shoes, your pants, your house, your food, your, you know, your insurance, your this, your that, your wrestling boots, your trunks. Okay. So what you do is whatever you make, you save at least 10%. It could be as much as you want, but no less than 10%.
Mm-hmm.
And you pay yourself first. When you get paid, take 10% out, and at least. And then at the end of the week, whatever is left goes into the same, you know, account. And then you put it to work for you. And the rules have never changed, and you know, since man rose up from the sludge. So within a year and a half, I had $10,000 saved. And then it was, now the only mistake I made, and I don't call it a complete mistake because I have a beautiful daughter, 24 years old, but the getting married part. But luckily, I was able to rebound from that dilemma, and I was young enough at the time to be able to, you know, naturally my stock dropped a bit, but I was able to rebound because I was young enough.
Yeah.
But I can, if I write my third book, it would be totally different and not poetry at all. It would be like a young man's guide, and I would tell them that prostitution is legal in Las Vegas, and it's legal in certain sections in Rhode Island and Las Vegas. I mean, not Las Vegas, but Nevada.
Yeah.
Yeah, not Las Vegas proper, but there's places where it's overlooked and there's places where it's just plain legal. But be careful because there's another form of prostitution that's legal all over, and it's called the professional divorcee. And, you know, like the greatest prostitute that ever lived was, I'm sure, Jackie Kennedy, because she married John Kennedy and Aristotle Onassis and cleaned up. You know, one the most handsome senator that became president, the other the ugliest man that ever lived. You know, and naturally, and they only had to stay married 5 years, and I'm sure that didn't involve too many trips up the stairs and down. But see, I believe there's two classifications, the lift and the load. And a woman pretends to be a lift, and then you marry her, and she turns out to be quite a load, in fact, a burden, in fact, a thief. And it's not just, I'm not speaking just from my own personal experience. You know, the most, Hulk Hogan is the most recent example, you know, where his wife is going for broke, you know, at the expense of everything.
Yep.
You know.
Yeah.
And, you know, let me explain something to you. In my 21 years in wrestling, I was either a big fish in a little pond or a little fish in a big pond. I was always a day late and a dollar short. I always saved my money, always invested it wisely. However, there was one brief shining moment where I drank from the silver chalice of success. And the man who was pouring was Hulk Hogan. And I promise you, even though he's not done anything for me lately, I can never, ever stop being grateful for him because I was his nemesis in 1989 and 1990.
Yep.
And that's the closest thing to that 4 months of time when I was in Madison Square Garden on top, when I was teamed with Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig, the greatest of them all. When we went in every, I was on NBC. And you know something, when people, you know, I like The Rock, but I wish he hadn't popularized the term jabroni and know your role jabroni.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I first came to, WWF, George Scott was the booker and he liked me because you know, and I liked him. We were in Charlotte together. And I had, for about 6 months, I had quite a push. Not to the top because all those spots were taken, but I wasn't, losing on television either. I was always being taken care of. So I remember I was on the road with David Sammartino, and David told me, he said, "Oh great, George Scott lost his booking job. Now I'm going to get a push. That guy's been holding me back." And I said, "David, don't be so sure. I've been around when bookers change. They bring in their own people. And, you know, the older people, the people that have been there a while, get pushed to the curb." So what happened is we go to Poughkeepsie, we're both losing. And he walked out. He couldn't take it. You know, he couldn't stand the fact that his shoulders are going to go down. I didn't like it either, but I did it and did it and did it for 4 more years. In the meantime, making about $100,000 a year and saving and supporting my family. And then all of a sudden, they give me a break, the genius, and a few months down the road, Hulk Hogan takes a liking to it and gets an idea. And, you know, the rest is history. And, like I say, I don't believe there is such a thing as a jabroni in this business because they're the ones that make you look good. I believe there's such a thing as a mark, and that's a person who doesn't save his money and, you know, doesn't... winds up with what he started.
Yeah, yeah.
Or less, you know.
Yes.
So anyway, or a mark as a person that gets married the second time, let's say. You know, like, to learn from the first time. Like Mickey Rooney, 8 times. And if you were here in the room, I'd have to insult him. Like, you didn't learn, you short little guy, you know?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I'm not happy for Hulk Hogan's problems. I'm sorry for Graziano's situation.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a crime of maliciousness. It was a crime of stupidity.
That's true.
You know, there's a lot of malicious people in jail, too, that with willful intent and forethought and malice, you know, get themselves killing people for no reason.
Yep.
And then, you know, this was just a stupid boy in a stupid moment, and they hope he learns from it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the victim is irrevocably, you know, I mean, if I could communicate to you, I would say, please kill me.
Because
a houseplant has a better life than you got.